As far as anyone knows, the term brainwashing was coined in 1950, but it refers to a much older concept, forcibly controlling someone's actions and thoughts. But although brainwashing has become a part of the popular culture, it's only recently been considered worthy of scientific attention. For this week's Please Explain, we've invited Dr. Kathleen Taylor, author of Brainwashing, The Science of Thought Control from Oxford University Press, and Dominic Streatfeild, author of Brainwash, The Secret History of Mind Control, which is published by Picador. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Dominic, who coined the term brainwashing? Do we know?
I think we probably do. It was a guy called Edward Hunter, who was a journalist, but as later research revealed, was actually working hand-in-hand with the Central Intelligence Agency in the early 1950s, and it was partly in response to some quite embarrassing goings-on in Korea where American servicemen had been captured and as prisoners of war had made confessions that they'd used biological weapons on North Korean and Chinese civilians.
And the assumption was that they actually had been convinced that that was the case, that they weren't just doing it to get through and survive?
That was the assumption. I mean, I think it would always be the case that non-commissioned officers might, under interrogation, buckle and make embarrassing confessions. But the fact that it was officers, and in some cases quite senior officers, and they were giving really explicit details about these top-secret germ warfare programs that just were not true. And the question is, you know, somebody might give away classified information under interrogation, but why would they fabricate a story that just isn't true? So what has been done to these guys to make them come up with these stories?
Well, Kathleen, does a viable form of brainwashing really exist, or is it an Orwellian fantasy?
Well, I'm sorry to sound like an academic, but it depends what you mean by brainwashing. If you're talking about some kind of mysterious process, some where people are taken away and something happens to them and they come back with a different personality, that doesn't happen.
The Manchurian Candidate?
The Manchurian Candidate is the classic example, yep, and nothing like that actually occurs. What does happen is that people change their minds, acquire bad beliefs, harmful beliefs, all sorts of things. So, I mean, yes, sure, it happens, but it's psychology. There's nothing mystical about it.
Well, today it's used rather casually, in fact, almost ironically at times. Because it has been so downgraded in the public's mind.
Well, actually, I think it's always been like that. Because as Dominic said, it was coined in very political circumstances. It was it's a propaganda term. So I think that it's always had that political edge to it. It's used by people to denigrate another group, whether it's a cult or an enemy force or whatever it happens to be. So I think brainwashing has always had that edge. Of course, the usage has spread from where it began.
So because it really is a product of Cold War fears, it's been considered unworthy of scientific attention until now? Is that why we have seen so little scientific interest in brainwashing?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
I said because it was seen – well, just let me ask, did some people think you were wasting your time when you wrote a book about brainwashing?
Oh, yes. I had someone tell me it was all hogwash, but I went ahead anyway.
Now, Dominic, you mentioned that this really begins with the Korean War. Did those returning prisoners continue to praise their captors and condemn the United States years after their release?
In some cases, they did. There were a number of them. I think 10 United States servicemen refused to come back at the end of the war, and there was one famous British serviceman who refused to come back at the end of the war, and this just heightened the story. My God, what have they done? You know, they've gone over to the communists, and they didn't even come back when they could have. But later on, all of them recanted and came up with explanations about why they'd made these confessions.
And in some cases, it had to do with troubles back home rather than because they'd actually gone through any major change in the way that they thought. Do we know about the techniques that were used on these prisoners?
Well, I mean, quite naturally, this wasn't just a propaganda term. There was a genuine fear that something strange had happened to these guys inside the Eastern Bloc. And so there were a number of committees set up in the United States and in the United Kingdom to investigate what are the communists doing. And I interviewed some of the guys who were on these committees, and they looked through it. And although the myth continued to circulate that this was brainwashing and it was hypnosis and it was drugs, the guy in charge of the British government's committee said, look, there was nothing mysterious about it. They had a fairly basic grasp of psychology and group psychology, and there was quite a lot of torture, but there was no sort of secret magic bullet that enabled them to steal the souls of Allied personnel.
Hasn't psychological manipulation during interrogation or torture been done for a very long time?
Yes, I'm sure it has. What was unusual about what the communists were doing at the time was, usually if you torture someone to get them to confess to something or to get them to give you information that they don't want to give up voluntarily, and you then put them in front of a television camera, perhaps in a show trial or in a courthouse, they've got black eyes, they're beaten up, they appear in a very bad condition. But what was unusual about the Cold War confessions was that these guys appeared to be almost normal. They didn't appear to have been beaten or tortured. And they spoke, they were sluggish and they spoke slowly, which was strange, almost as if in a, some sort of hypnotic trance. But otherwise they appeared to be normal. So it looked to the viewers in the West like this is not a physical procedure. This is some kind of psychological mystery and they've been tampering with their minds. And what are they doing?
Kathleen, are there any ethical ways that people could actually research what happens during this process? Are you there, Kathleen? I guess we've lost Kathleen. Dominic, obviously, if you do the sorts of things that the North Koreans and the Chinese were accused of doing, even under the most
hello,
Kathleen.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes. Did you hear my question?
I did, yes, and I was going to say that it depends on how flexible your ethics are, because I think a certain amount of research has gone on, for example, the CIA research that went on in the 70s, and sure, you can do it. In terms of actually doing proper, modern, ethically acceptable scientific research, it would be very difficult to do that, because what's going on is coercive and stressful and often extremely damaging. So it would be very hard to do that in a modern, sort of like a university setting.
What are the conditions necessary for brainwashing? Would you have to use hypnosis?
No, you don't have to use hypnosis. What you have to use is a combination of, it's basically psychological techniques that we use all the time to persuade and to pass messages to other people. But they're used very intensely and they're used in combination. So, for example, I talk about five techniques in the book: isolation, control, uncertainty, repetition, and emotion. You put all those together and you put them together intensively, you can achieve a really remarkable amount of effect on the brain, if you like. You can make people very stressed out, very tired, and the longer you do it, of course, the more effective it is.
So it has to be done one-on-one, because isolation is a factor here. It would be impossible to conduct brainwashing on a mass scale?
No, it depends what you mean. Again, think of brainwashing as a kind of dimensional thing, you know? It's either going to be very, very extreme, or it can be anything down to, you know, really mild persuasion, okay? So brainwashing is what we call the extreme end, basically, but it's all the same kind of psychological technique.
Go ahead.
So you can do milder brainwashing on a mass scale, sure. Often one-to-one, I mean, some people argue that that's what's going on in some of these very abusive domestic violence scenarios, for example. Uh-huh. With cults and things, it's more like many-to-one. Because, you know, if you're doing something like, for example, an interrogation, you need people there all the time. So you've got to have more than one person doing it.
Could the almost mindless belief in Chairman Mao during the Cultural Revolution, or of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il in North Korea, be the result of a kind of mass brainwashing?
Well, if you're talking about using these techniques, this common sort of psychological technique ramped up, yes, I think so. I think isolation, for example, has got a lot to do with the North Korean case.
Dominic, have we seen it in other situations? Did the Nazis do this? Did Stalin do it? Was Chairman Mao's re-education program a form of brainwashing?
I think it's quite difficult to answer these questions because, as we've discussed already, brainwashing is not really a scientific term. It was coined for the media specifically. And when you actually get down to what is brainwashing, people don't seem to know. And every now and again there are court cases against religious cults here in the United States. And they say, well, this cult brainwashed somebody. And then there's a huge debate. What does brainwash mean? Does it mean hypnosis? Does it mean drugs? Does it mean this? Does it mean that? Does it mean applying psychological pressure? Or is it some combination of all of those? So if you talk about Nazi Germany or Chairman Mao, was it brainwashing? Well, it depends on your definition of brainwashing, I think.
My guests are Dominic Streatfeild, who has written a book called Brainwash, The Secret History of Mind Control, and Dr. Kathleen Taylor, who is the author of Brainwashing, The Science of Thought Control. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we're talking about brainwashing on today's Please Explain. Later, we'll be taking your calls at 646-778-3729. That's 646-778-3729. Well, the both of you have mentioned cults. Well, where do we draw the line here? For example, would religious instruction from an early age be a form? I realize we shouldn't be using the word of brainwashing, but a form of whatever it is that we are discussing.
It depends what you mean. If you think of this as being a dimensional thing of persuasion, so you can use these same techniques to persuade someone to do something with perfectly free choice and, you know, no coercion, no stress, no nothing. You can take those same techniques and you can put them together much more intensively and you can do something very coercive and harmful, okay? So the problem is not what techniques you're using, it's how you're using them and whether you're using them with coercion, with force.
But doesn't it also require collaboration from the person who is being coerced or brainwashed? Some people, it doesn't seem to work with others. It does. People join cults usually as a matter of choice. They have a certain inclination. Maybe they also have weaker egos and so are more vulnerable.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, most people join cults, I think, in their early teens or after very stressful life events. I think I'm with Dominic here. You know, the term brainwashing, conceived of as some kind of magic process that is done to people, is not helpful. What we're talking about is different types of, basically, psychology.
Dominic, what was the CIA's program? Is it MKUltra?
MKUltra. Well, there were a number of programs that sprang into action, although the precursor to the CIA, the OSS, had been looking into truth drugs even during the Second World War. They were very interested in the idea of truth drugs and this kind of stuff. And the program kind of morphed as after the Central Intelligence Agency was formed.
They used LSD as one of the drugs.
Well, they did. The initial question was, what are they doing to these guys in Korea? What have they been doing at the show trials in Moscow? And could we do it? And it started off as kind of a defensive program. If you were, as a Central Intelligence Agency officer, if you were caught, what might they do to you? So what could we do to prepare you for that sort of experience? But it very quickly crossed the line into an offensive use of all the same techniques that they thought the Soviets might be using. So it ranged from truth drugs to hallucinogenic drugs to sensory deprivation to the Central Intelligence Agency was certainly very interested in hypnosis for a long period of time and went out of their way to try and work out what they could get people to do under hypnosis. Could you hypnotize somebody who didn't want to be hypnotized? Could you get them to break the law? Could you get a diplomat from another embassy to steal documents and give them to you? And ultimately, could you get somebody under a hypnotic state to assassinate somebody else without knowing why they'd done it or that they'd done it at all?
Have all of these things been abandoned by the CIA, or are we seeing versions of them now at Guantanamo Bay or CIA black sites?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's no doubt that the research that went on in the 50s, 60s, and 70s bore fruit, and for the British intelligence and military services as well. I interviewed a lot of interrogators from the British intelligence community who were specifically banned from using certain techniques after an experiment in Northern Ireland in 1971 when they took 12 IRA suspects and subjected them to a very, very intense process known as the five techniques. And it went to court. The Prime Minister said, we will never do this again. It'll never happen again. And yet I interviewed one of the interrogators concerned, and he said he was watching the news. This was 3 or 4 years ago. He was watching the news, and he saw a bunch of guys in Iraq with hoods on. And he said to his friend, who was also an intelligence operator, he said, wasn't that what we were banned from doing 30 years ago? And the guy said, yes.
So putting the hoods on their heads was a form of isolating them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a form of inducing sensory deprivation.
Now, Kathleen, how malleable are our brains?
More malleable than most people think, to be honest. There's at the physical level, there's evidence that they grow and change throughout life. It doesn't all stop when you're 18 years old. So they really are quite changeable. And also, they're very, very dependent on what is actually coming in the way of sensory information. That's basically one of the reasons why this brainwashing type of techniques work.
But I'm sure they would be most effective with young people because their brains are more plastic.
Well, it's not so much a question of physical plasticity. I mean, in a sense, it's if you think of a new information coming in, like a belief in communism, for example, that's got to compete with what's already in your head. If you've got very strong established beliefs already, then that belief, if you like, the new one, has to work harder to get in there and influence your behavior. Whereas if you don't have strong beliefs, if you're looking for things, if you're not sure what you think about things, then it's much more easy to manipulate you.
And does this cut across all cultures?
Yes, it does, but culture makes a difference.
Do advertisers and marketers subtly use the methods of brainwashing, as some people suggest?
Yeah, emotional manipulation, of course they do, all the time. Repetition, because they show the ads over and over again. Isolation, well, not so much because they can't do that. But control and uncertainty, I think they probably would if they could.
Well, isolation if you're a couch potato.
Yes.
Dr. Kathleen Taylor is the author of Brainwashing, The Science of Thought Control, published by Oxford University Press. Dominic Streatfeild is the author of Brainwash, The Secret History of Mind Control, published by Picador. And we're talking about brainwashing on today's Please Explain, taking your calls at 646-778-3729. We will continue the conversation after this. And we are back with Dominic Streatfeild and Dr. Kathleen Taylor talking about brainwashing, whether it exists or it doesn't exist, and the limits of psychological coercion on today's Please Explain. Our number here is 646, that's the area code, 778-3729. Let's go to Jean from Manhattan. Hi, Jean. Well, excuse me for a second. We're using some new equipment here. Jean, are you there?
I am.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Is there a difference between acculturation and brainwashing?
Yes, there is, I guess, but it's a line that will vary. Acculturation is much less coercive. Okay, brainwashing generally involves either a lot of deceit or a lot of force.
But acculturation, for example, in many religious groups that isolate themselves from the rest of the world, isn't there? Don't we see many of the things that we see in what we call brainwashing? Although it's perfectly acceptable because they're accepted religious groups.
Yes, and again, there's the whole political edge to all of that. Some religious cults do use techniques like this. They use isolation, control, uncertainty. But a lot of it depends on how coercive it is. I mean, some cults, a lot of them, for example, they will recruit a lot of people to an initial event, but very few will actually stay. As long as you've got the choice to walk out, the coercion is limited.
We go now to Caleb. Caleb, are you on the air? Let's try that again. We are, as I said, we're using new equipment, and I'm not sure that... it's Caleb. Hi.
Yes. Hi.
So,
yes,
go ahead.
My question is, I just happened to be tuning in, and it was very interesting, the brainwashing topic, because I always wondered, while I was in the Marine Corps, especially in boot camp, some of the things that they did, for example, like before you're allowed to eat your food, you have to say things like, what makes the grass grow? Blood, blood, blood. What do we do? Kill, kill, kill. And it's really the repetition that I heard you speaking about. That's one of the things that I noticed. I my question is that considered brainwashing, the techniques used by the Marines?
It depends. I mean, there's actually, I believe, a case coming to court fairly soon, if it hasn't already, about this exact question. In a sense, that's a legal judgment, not a scientific one. What I say as a scientist is that, look, many of the techniques that are going to be used are going to be the same. Is there coercion? Yeah. Can you back out? Well, it's a legal judgment. Certainly some of the techniques that are used in the military are very intense because, like anything else, these techniques have evolved. They've learned a lot. They've specialized, techniques of interrogation, torture, you name it. they've all developed over the recent years.
To some degree, isn't brainwashing what your enemy does?
Mm-hmm. It certainly is. It's, I mean, as I said before, it's got that propagandistic aspect to it. It's the term that you use about things you don't like.
And what we do is perfectly fine because, in fact, recently John McCain said that he felt there that our military should be trained to have more respect for American foreign policy than it's being given.
Mm-hmm. Dominic?
Just thinking to go back to the military analogy, I did kind of look into this. There are certainly elements of indoctrination if you join a new school, perhaps a university, and you join a fraternity or sorority, and perhaps you pledge allegiance to the flag. These are elements that you are perhaps not able to opt out of when you arrive at school or a university. And in the military, they do separate people. You're separated from non-military people. You perhaps shave your head. You wear a uniform. You have a very strict regime that you have to do, and they shout at you a lot. And they don't let you sleep very much. So on those situations, you could argue, I think, that there are elements of coercion, mind control, or brainwashing, whatever you want to call it. Those elements are certainly present. But the difference is, I think, and this was put to me by somebody who'd fought against the Unification Church in the 1970s, the Unification Church and many of the cases that have come to court and been won against it, it was recruiting under false premises. It gave a false name. They didn't say, we're the Moonies. They said, we're an organization of friends, that kind of stuff. So you were sucked in to something. You didn't know it was the Unification Church. And without telling you what they were going to do, they withdrew you from society, put you into a very high-pressure, intense environment, and then worked on you for a while until, when they thought you were safely indoctrinated, they would tell you, actually, we're the Unification Church. I don't think anybody would argue that when you sign up to join the military, and I'm an ex-military officer myself, you know what you're going to expect. You've seen it on TV. There's no secret about the training. You're going to wear a uniform, they're going to cut off all your hair, and they're going to shout at you, and you're going to march a lot. And you can resign at any point. So there's no secret, and I think that is an important difference between a military training and indoctrination, if you want to call it, and what we might call as brainwashing.
Thank you so much for calling us, Caleb. Kathleen, we were talking about the Unification Church. There's a whole group of people who call themselves deprogrammers. Are they doing the same sort of thing, only in reverse?
Yes, I don't know. I mean, I know some deprogramming still goes on, but there was a lot of legal fuss over that because some of the techniques that they were using were basically kidnapping people. And, of course, these people are adults. Now, setting aside the issue of how coercive the Unification Church is, and, I mean, brainwashing is not just about force. It's not just about picking people up deliberately and beating them up. It's about deceit and, false pretenses and effectively presenting yourself as something you aren't. Of course it is. But
there are a lot of people out there who are looking for some kind of connection, and they try out a whole bunch of different churches and eventually stick with one. We might say that they have been abducted by a cult. They might say, I just simply found the group that I feel comfortable with.
Yes, I mean, a lot of it depends on whether they can get out if they want to or not. That's a really important message. In a brainwashing situation, in the sense of it being very coercive, the whole point is that you cannot escape it. You have no alternative. You're in that situation. You can't get out of it. In something where you can get out, that's not quite the same. They don't have that level of coercion.
But what happened? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, having said which, again, it's a gray area because some things can be manipulated so that you don't really think you want to get out when, in fact, it would be better for you if you did.
But I asked earlier about long-lasting effects of people who had been accused of being brainwashed in Korea. Some of them maintain those thoughts way after they were out of the prison setting. So had they just been re-educated?
Dominic?
Sorry. I think the issue of long-lasting effects is quite important. I interviewed one lady in the United States who had become a Unification Church member in the 1970s, and her brother had become a Unification Church member to get her out and had later gone on to become one of the most famous of the deprogrammers and had actually kidnapped her later on to get her out forcibly, and she escaped and went back to the church. And I met her in Harvard, and I asked her, look, your brother thinks you're brainwashed and you're still there. And she said, look, it's been 25, 30 years. I've had plenty of opportunity to leave. If I wanted to, I could have. So my impression would be, look, this is a free choice. She's had 30 years to think about this without any stress, and she's still there. she wanted to be a member of the Unification Church. But when I put that to her brother, he was livid and said, no, her mind was changed and she's not thinking clearly anymore. And it's almost impossible to draw the line. And the only decision you can make is which side you're on is going to determine which way you call it. Was she brainwashed or did she choose? And they will never agree on that issue.
And we hear the same thing when people change their political affiliations, when they become Scientologists. I guess it's if you disagree with the new position of a loved one, then you just assume that they've been brainwashed.
Exactly, and I think that's helped by the fact that we don't really know what brainwashing is because it's this kind of fluffy media term, and it's used nowadays, particularly by the press, to explain behavior that is abhorrent to people on the outside. So if your son does something that you can't explain, he perhaps joins a weird religious cult and shaves off all his hair or becomes a Muslim or moves to Afghanistan or, God help us, you know, bombs a bus in Palestine, you go, what on earth could have persuaded him to do that? Somebody must have got to him. And I interviewed the father of Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, and said, why do you think your son tried to blow up this plane? He said, somebody got to him. He was brainwashed. But if you asked him, he would go, no, I did it for very good reasons. The problem is the reasons are so complex that it's difficult to put them in a newspaper, and it's easier for the journalist to say, brainwash.
But, Kathleen, people can be changed. They can, whether we call it brainwashing or something else, they can be psychologically manipulated. So should we just come up with another word?
Well, I mean, I don't think we're going to get rid of the word brainwashing because it's so easy. It's just this wonderful catch-all term that just reeks of evil, and it's great, great for media. So I don't think we're going to get rid of that anytime soon. But, I mean, you know, a psychologist would describe this having lots of different elements in it. Okay, so we would break that down into different elements, and we would say, well, it's a process of persuasion or coercion or belief change or something, you know? But we wouldn't use the term brainwashing as a scientific concept anyway. So, I mean, it's a media concept. It's not, there is a scientific basis to it in the sense that what's going on is basic psychological manipulation. But that does not mean that there is an event that happens, which is brainwashing.
My guest on today's Please Explain it, Dr. Kathleen Taylor, who's the author of Brainwashing, The Science of Thought Control, and Dominic Streatfeild, author of Brainwash, The Secret History of Mind Control. And we are taking your calls at 646-778-3729. Mitchell from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to know if it's really possible to plant subliminal messages that can change people's behavior.
Subliminal messages.
We used to hear a lot about that, especially when people claimed that you'd go to the movies and they would have these little nanosecond messages telling you that you were thirsty and you should go out and buy a Coke.
What we do know is that a lot of what the brain acts on, a lot of what the influences are that come into it are ones that we just do not recognize. Okay, so most of what we think about and do is not actually conscious. So in that sense, there's subliminal information coming in all the time. But, I mean, you know, there's no magic or mystery about that. It's just that the brain receives a whole lot more than we actually recognize. So in that sense, yeah, you can get subliminal messages. But, I mean, we do that all the time with language anyway. I mean, we use words with particular emotions attached to make people feel a certain way even though they don't know it. So it's not something that you need particularly special technology for. It's just something that we do all the time.
A listener left a comment on our show page asking if there is an effective positive use of brainwashing, for example, reprogramming child molesters.
You can use methods of belief change. I mean, belief change in the sense of psychological manipulation to make people act differently and believe different things. I mean, that's the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy. So, yes, indeed, there are positive uses of psychology just as there are negative ones. But, I mean, some people would say that, you know, you can use brainwashing positively. It just depends on your politics.
Could I jump in and say something about subliminal images?
Sure.
I did a chapter in the book about the Judas Priest trial where two kids shot themselves supposedly after listening to a Judas Priest album which contained a hidden message, and the hidden message said, do it. And there was a big court case in Reno, Nevada, and I interviewed all the lawyers and all the defendants, the ones who were surviving, including the judge, and the verdict was, it doesn't work. And when you look back at the history of subliminal images and subliminal flash frame imagery, it was created by a particular publicist in, I believe, 1953 called Vickery. And he came up with this experiment that he announced, which was the Eat Popcorn, Drink Coke experiment, and he made it sound very scientific. And that was how we first heard of subliminal imagery. And there was some truth in it, and that it is possible to flash images at people and they can perhaps not recognize what the image is, but then guess, well, it was a triangle, and they'll prove that that was right, it was a triangle. So they've absorbed the information faster than they were aware of. However, there is no indication whatsoever that people will act on those messages, whether it's do it, drink Coke, eat popcorn, or anything. The science just doesn't stand up. And Vickery later went on the record and admitted that it was a fraud. The whole story was a fraud made out of, like most of these techniques, there's a grain of truth in there. But the kind of science fiction writers and perhaps the populist journalists run with it and say, well, if you can recognize a triangle without seeing it, could you get somebody to commit suicide? And it's you're heading into fiction territory.
And now we wind up with people claiming that video games will brainwash teenagers into murder, committing crimes, because their brains have been changed. They've been rewired.
I mean, I agree with Dominic. There's a lot of evidence that you can absorb information without recognizing it. There's a lot of information that you can manipulate emotions without people realizing, sure. But that's a long way from saying that somebody's going to watch a video game and then go out and kill people.
Let's take a call from Bob from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering the extent to which the study of brainwashing isn't really the flip side, in the sense of the kind of torture we've ended up having at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. As I understand it, there was research in the 50s, the era that your guests are talking about, by the Navy, which was an attempt to create preventive techniques so that armed forces personnel couldn't be brainwashed. And that this research actually was what was relied on by the U.S. government recently to come up with torture techniques at Guantanamo. And further, we learned that the Pentagon has a continuing, just initiated this new program to use academics to work on the psychology of terrorism and so forth. And I'm, you know, wondering what your guest's reaction is to that.
Thank you for calling. Can
I leap in on this one?
Yes, go ahead.
I think you're completely right. And if you want to see an example of how it happened, you just have to look at what the British Army did in 1971 in Northern Ireland. And they came up with the techniques that had been used to train spies and special forces operatives to prevent themselves being interrogated and coerced. And that was how they'd been trained. When it actually got applied, it turned out that the techniques that we were supposed to use to stop being brainwashed were applied aggressively by us against them. Because word of mouth had simply just spread the news that this is how interrogation happens. And that's pretty much what seems to have happened with Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo. These people don't really know. There are professional interrogators, and they do know what they're doing. But quite a lot of it is not professional interrogators who've seen the movies and heard the talk, and that's what they do. And if you look at the Guantanamo pictures, the techniques that they're using in Abu Ghraib, the hooding, the wall standing, the white noise, the food and sleep deprivation, these are exactly the same techniques that the British tested out in 1971 and that we got taken to the International Court and found guilty of using.
And we thank you both so much for being with us. Dominic Streatfeild is the author of Brainwashed, The Secret History of Mind Control, published by Picador. Dr. Kathleen Taylor is author of Brainwashing, The Science of Thought Control, from Oxford University Press.